You're listening to a Hebrew in Israel podcast with Yoel HaLevi, exploring the language, culture, and history of the Bible. For more information, visit us at HebrewInIsrael.net.
Shalom everyone, welcome again to another episode of the Hebrew in Israel Haftarah series. I'm Yoel HaLevi, your host. And I'm here to remind you that all the recordings are available on iTunes and on the website. And if you find them a blessing, you can go and support the programming by going to the website and clicking the donation button. All recordings are free, and you are more than welcome to share them, listen to them, make comments, and so on. Now, just a bit of a note again in connection to previous recordings. This recording is the third, this haftarah, more correctly, this haftarah is the third haftarah of the Tlat de Pur'anuta. It's an Aramaic term, the three of the disaster, which relate to the period between the 17th of the fourth month, what is designated as the fast of the fourth month, but specifically designated to the second temple, the destruction of the second temple, while the destruction of the first temple was on the 9th of the fourth month, and all the way to the 9th of the fifth month, that's the second temple, and then, depending on different sources, but either the, if you remember correctly, it's either the 4th or the 10th of the fifth month, where the first temple was destroyed. And as I have already pointed out, I think that the destruction of the first temple was much more severe than destruction of the second temple, because it actually completely and utterly destroyed the historical entity, and everything that happened in the second temple was really a shadow of that reality, where the temple didn't have the ark, and a lot of the practices were eventually influenced by arguments by Hellenistic cultures and so on. And this is why I perceive the destruction of the first temple as a much more severe occurrence. But during the times of the second temple, when the second temple was destroyed, the leadership of the time perceived the destruction of the second temple being much more severe. And it is also based on the fact that the destruction still stands to this very day, and therefore the destruction of the first temple becomes less important to the Jewish world, but to the people living at the time as well, because it was actually restored to some degree. But you can go into the discussion of to what level was it really, and you know, was really the presence of God there. It's a very, very interesting, very intriguing subject that can be discussed, but it's not really for us right now. So this is the third prophecy, and I have a little story about this specific reading. It happens to be my older brother's bar mitzvah reading, and you know, for us, bar mitzvah is a big thing, and you go ahead and you read the portion in front of everyone, because reading the Torah in front of everyone is a community obligation, and you can't really fulfill this obligation until you consider to be an adult. And by doing so, you are publicly demonstrating your ability not only to read, but also that you are doing an action that requires an adult for others to be considered as if they fulfilled that requirement. And what this means is that brothers kind of slightly compete with one another over this thing. And what was really funny is that I was sitting there, and kind of funny to me, but maybe my brother didn't appreciate it really that much. But the his teacher would come to our house and read with them, and I would just sit down and listen. And eventually I started reciting what they were learning, and my brother got really upset with me. So I have a personal connection with this specific story. But I also have a personal connection with this one, because I actually researched this period as a paper that I had to give in. And I've mentioned this before, and this is actually going to be a little bit the background of what are we're looking at. So, first of all, one of the interesting things about the book of Isaiah is, unlike Yirmiyahu and Yechezkel, which start with the dedication of them as prophets, and specifically the opening of their mouths, as I've mentioned before, Jeremiah or Yirmiyahu eats, God touches his mouth. In Yechezkel, he has to eat the scroll written from both sides. We only hear this in chapter 6. In chapter 6, Isaiah has a vision And this is really, it's Chazon Yishayahu v'Namotz. Chazon really comes from the word chazah, to see. It's a vision. And there's an interesting study that I've been reading lately about the difference between just having spirit and actually having visions, and visions really being a much more, I would say, real type of prophecy. I want to be very careful how I put this together, but a much more real type of prophecy versus a just having spirit and basically prophesying. This was a comment that I actually a commentary that I read on the stories of the 70 or 72 elders in the desert, where Moses' spirit, the spirit that was upon Moses, came upon the upon Moshe, came upon them as well. And also the story of King Yehoshaphat, when he showed up with Ahab and they went to war against Aram. And there are 400 prophets there, mitnabiim, to prophesy, but they're not seeing visions. And then Michayhu ben Nimla, and also Moshe, they both are described as people who see visions. Moshe is described as seeing a clear vision of things. And Michayhu actually sees a vision up in the heavens. And they're both seeing visions. So there's a difference here between just having led by a spirit versus actually seeing visions, which is considered to be a much more, I wouldn't say real necessarily, but a much more prominent, a much more powerful way of prophecy. That's really what happens here with Yishayahu. He sees a lot of visions. Yishayahu is probably the most debated prophet you can imagine, based on two issues. First of all, always the messianic argument that has been in existence for a very, very long time, but also placing these prophecies in different timelines. And that's really one of the problems with Yishayahu. Most of his prophecies are really connected, and I'm talking about the first half of Yishayahu. The second half of Yishayahu is another discussion by itself. There's a lot of theories about it as well. But the first half of Yishayahu, we have two basic problems with it. First of all, it says that he prophesied during the times of Uzziahu, Yotam, Ahaz, and Yechizkiyahu. But really, most of his prophecies relate to Ahaz and Chizkiyahu. And by the way, I just want to apologize for the background noise that might sometimes pop up. There's a insulation issue in the room I work from, hoping to fix it one day. But right now, I can't really afford to insulate this entire room to make sure no noises come in. So again, I apologize for it. But the thing that we also have, besides the prophecies mostly being, you know, he says he prophesied from this period to that period, and then mostly we see Ahaz and Yechizkiyahu, and there's actually an answer to that one. The other problem we have, and this is a well-known problem with certain books of prophecy, but especially with Yishayahu, is that he's talking about a very generalized period. This is a very difficult period in ancient Israel. The northern kingdom has been slowly dismantled by the Assyrians. We're talking about a period where there are several Assyrian kings, Tiglath-Pileser III or Tiglath-Pileser III, who's attacking, he's suppressing rebellions against him. We have, after him, we appear other kings as well, like Sanherib, who actually puts a siege on Jerusalem. There's a very famous cylinder that you can actually see in the Israel Museum where he specifically talks about King Chizkiyahu, Azekau, as he calls him there. Assyrian loses some of its gutturals. It's not Chizkiyahu. It kind of loses some of the sounds. It's interesting that the Au sound, or Yahoo sound as we use it in Hebrew, is attested there as well. So the Assyrians knew how they pronounced some words. Actually, Assyrians, people who wrote in Assyrian and Babylonian, knew how to supplement certain sounds when there were vowel points that they didn't have, but consonants they didn't, because they didn't have a symbol for it. So they tried to find some kind of a close, like a hu became an u, a chi became just a vowel point e. So this is a very, 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 very difficult period. And, but we don't necessarily have titles to each prophecy when he says it. So for example, he might mention specifically Chizkiyahu or Ahaz. He never really talks about Uzziahu or Yotam. And as I said, there's a reason for this, and I'll get to it in a moment. but we don't have dates. So for example, Yirmiyahu and Yechezkel actually do have dates in many cases. So we can track things, and we can actually, if you go through the dates, you'll notice that things are set next to one another because of context, not necessarily because of chronology, because there's a message to be sent, and it's, chronology is less of importance, at least in books of prophecy. In books like Kings and so on, then it's a little different because you have to be able to point out when each person lived and so on. So there's a different method there. Now, the issue with why do we actually hear about Uzziah and Yotam really connects to Ahaz. The issue between Uzziah, Yotam, and Ahaz is Uzziah was a king who lived a very, very, very long time. But according to the book of Chronicles, and I think we can trust Chronicles in this one, though one day maybe I'll have a discussion about Chronicles, what are the issues with Chronicles. But Chronicles describes that King Uzziah was cursed with leprosy because he went into the temple to try to offer incense, which was really something only the priests would do. And he was struck with leprosy and he was kicked out. Leprosy is like death. So really, Uzziah was in the background and Yotam had to step in. Yotam wasn't really king, or he was really king regent, because his father couldn't function. At the same time, Ahaz is already stepping in as king regent because Uzziah is really deteriorating. Yotam is recognized as king, but Ahaz is already becoming king regent as well. Yotam doesn't really live for very, very long. And there's probably a massive overlap of the different kings with one another. When I wanted to propose a reconstruction of the history of the period, it became very, very, very difficult. And I actually had to openly tell my professor that I have to forfeit this possibility or this discussion because it was very, very difficult. But what I did discover is that King Uzziah is mentioned as a king who may or may have not made a treaty with the Assyrian king. And, you know, one day we'll talk about this research that I did. But it looks like Uzziah lived very, very close by and was still considered somewhat king, very close by the time of Ahaz. And Yotam is never really mentioned in the Assyrian documents. It's as if he skipped over. So really, the period of, and the reason we don't really hear about the other kings is because their functionality was very partial in comparison to a king like Ahaz and Chizkiyahu, who were kings for a much longer period. Now, we have to understand this is a period of great turmoil to everyone. Ahaz is locked from different directions. One of the prophecies, one of the very famous segments about Ahaz from chapter 7 all the way to chapter 11 is Ahaz having to deal with threats from other kingdoms as well. And he eventually has to surrender to Assyria. And there's a whole that was really the subject of my research paper. Why did he surrender? Did he really surrender? Was it really a real surrender? Was it something else? And then we have Chizkiyahu. Chizkiyahu is presented as the opposite of his father. Ahaz is considered to be a wicked king. Chizkiyahu is already considered to be a very righteous king. And Yishayahu really, towards the end of the section, all the way to chapter 39, is mostly dealing with Chizkiyahu. But even with Ahaz, he's always trying to push him to believe more and to trust God and not go in the way of everyone else. And Yishayahu is really the prophet of hope. Yirmiyahu and Yechezkel are prophets of a lot of anger, a lot of strain. You know, Yirmiyahu has to deal with the people attacking him all the time. Yishayahu as well, but Yechezkel as well, he's like always in the background having to criticize. Yechezkel uses some of the most difficult language anywhere in the Bible. He says some things which are completely shocking. Yishayahu is a prophet of a lot of hope. A lot of what he does there is hope. And even when he says doom is coming, he still always points out to hope, because that's really that was really what he had to do during the time of Ahaz and Chizkiyahu, because there was a threat, a massive threat. You have to understand the proportion of what this means. Think of probably even bigger than the Six Day War. You're talking about as if an army in the size of the Russian army, which is gigantic. Okay, you can actually Google the statistics of the Russian army. The Russian army is basically marching towards basically the state of Israel today. The proportion here is insane. And you have this prophet turning around, because if Russia would attack Israel, there wouldn't be much left of us. Let's be very frank about it. And if you think about that threat, and there's this prophet standing there and saying, have hope. He's basically cheerleading everyone, have hope, have hope, have hope. This is really the message that kind of goes through the entire book. And this is really what Yeshayahu is mostly about, giving hope. He's the prophet of hope. This is why most of the readings that we have, which are the seven readings of Nechama, of condolence, of giving peace to everyone, is mostly from Yeshayahu, because that's really the character of Yeshayahu. Yirmiyahu talks a lot about hope around the chapter 30, 31, but he's mostly about the destruction. Yechezkel is the same. Only the end of the book of Yechezkel really focuses on the resurrection of the dead, or basically the dry bones, we would call it. So the resurrection of the people. But Yeshayahu is really strongly focused on the idea of hope. And he's strongly focused on God is on your side. And you have to understand, this is a period, Ahaz is perceived as a wicked king. Chizkiyahu is a king that goes ahead and does what, as Rav Shakeh puts it, it's an insanity to go out and destroy all the altars and everything and just go say, this one temple, this one place. It was absolute insanity. It was not realistic. I mean, people were arguing, and you can see it there. There are places, and you can actually notice that there was apparently arguments in the city. People were arguing, what's the most realistic thing to do? So Yeshayahu here is standing, and this really connects to that chapter. So we're talking about the second half of the 8th century BCE. It seems the prophecy here specifically is when the land is already desolate. And he actually states this. So this is probably after the Assyrians go ahead and destroy the entire land. You need to understand the magnitude of the destruction. Because if you read the cylinder, you actually notice this is exactly what was going on. What I want to try to do here right now is bring up the words of the cylinder and actually explain, so you can get an idea of what we're reading. Because the text itself of this Haftarah is very, very straightforward. The message is very, 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 very straightforward. So the cylinder contains 49 lines, and he mentions different kings. And there are, Chizkiyahu is actually mentioned twice, but the most important one appears in lines 18 all the way to, it goes away all the way to line 31. So it says, as for Chizkiyahu, the Jew, it's really translated as Jew, but it's not, it's really Judean. Using the term Jew only really appears during the Roman era. So Yehudi, he really means someone of Judea, who did not surrender to my yoke. 46 of his fortified cities and small cities, which were many in the region, I destroyed them with the ramming with the ramming rams. Probably means that they actually had heads of rams in them as well. And by the way, the Assyrians, they always depict their sieges on cities and everything. There's some really horrific imagery sometimes that you can see, because they would crucify people as well. And so I destroyed them by smashing them with the rams, and by bringing my siege vessels and attacking of foot soldiers, and by digging holes underneath the wall. They basically said, oh, there's a wall, let's dig underneath it. And I sieged upon them and I took them. 200,150 great, small men, so actually he says women, men, horses, asses, donkeys, camels, ox and sheep with no number. I bought from there and I counted as bounty. And he himself, Hezekiah, was trapped as a bird in a in a cage. I have locked him up in Jerusalem, the city of his kingship. So it's really interesting. He doesn't mention Jerusalem. He doesn't mention that he conquered Jerusalem. I only mention he destroyed the land. So really, what the theory is that, well, not theory. We actually know that if you actually look at the wall relief from Sennacherib's palace, you actually discover that they put a siege on the city of Lachish. You actually can go to Lachish. They excavated there again back in 2014, if I'm not mistaken, and they discovered more new things. It's a very interesting site. And Lachish was a very, very old city, predates the Israelites, but it was eventually taken by Israel and Judea. It was probably functioned as a secondary capital. I had an interesting back and forth with one of my professors and then another doctorate that I know is an archaeologist, and trying to figure out what their opinions are about the subject. But it looks like as if it really was the capital, as the administrative capital of Israel. And he actually specifically mentions, I built a ramp against him. Anyone who came out from the city, I returned him to his sorrow. His cities, which I looted, I tore away from his land. Now, this is real. We know as fact that this is real. We actually can see the destruction of the period. But what's interesting is also the mentioning of the ramp in line 29, because we know of a ramp in Lachish. I don't know if there was ever a ramp discovered next to Jerusalem. So there's a bit of a mixture here. And this is the problem with Assyrian inscriptions. They can tell us the truth, but they also overboast. There's a boasting here that they do, which is sometimes complete nonsense. But it's a very, very interesting, very live description. You can actually see the wall reliefs and see exactly what they did. They killed a lot of people, and they actually exiled a lot of people as well. So this description is very, very, very realistic, because it actually does fit what we see about the destruction of the area. We can see the siege and we can see the destruction. So Yeshayahu standing with this, and they know that the Judean plains are under siege and under attack. Jerusalem is all the way up in the mountains, and for the Assyrians to go all the way up there is quite a nightmare. But they apparently do. It's very clear. I think it's pretty clear that they do. But he never mentions that he conquers Jerusalem. He actually folds back. One of the interesting things is Sennacherib actually eventually folds back, and he just retreats for some reason. It's very unclear. Well, the Bible tells us what happened there. But I think even if you argue that maybe the description of the Bible is too miraculous, it still points out to something very, very real. The Assyrians didn't conquer Jerusalem. Jerusalem was saved, which, by the way, probably upped the attitude of most people towards Jerusalem, even from the northern tribes. But what's more important here as well is that we actually have a correlation here. What the Bible describes, Jerusalem not conquered, the Assyrians get up and leave. It's very unclear. I've heard someone argue, oh, it's because the Egyptians were on the way. I don't think that's the case. I think something scared them and they ran away. But it's from an historical perspective, not from a biblical perspective, but from a historical perspective, it's something that you can argue until you're blue in the face. The Assyrians would never admit defeat. He doesn't admit defeat here. He says, oh yeah, I did this and this and that. But you never conquered the capital. You never really conquered the big capital. Jerusalem was bigger than Lachish. But it was still, in the destruction of Lachish, was still a massive, massive blow. So you're under siege. Almost everything is destroyed. But it is important to point out that north of Jerusalem, the lands of Benjamin, we don't really see any destruction. And I think it's quite possible that the Assyrians either were not interested to go into the mountain and start traveling on the mountain plain and going into Benjamin, but it's also quite possible that the Assyrians made a claim that might be a division between Benjamin, between the lands of Binyamin and Judea and Yehuda, and said, well, this is a separate government. They didn't really rebel against us. It's quite possible. It's an interesting subject that I had to study, but we don't see the level of destruction in Binyamin as we see in Judea. In Binyamin, it's either very minimal to almost non-existent. But under this type of threat, Yeshayahu is running around saying, have hope, have hope, have hope. So it says, Hazon Yeshayahu, we're actually going to now go into the text, Hazon Yeshayahu ven Amotz. So we have his name is Yeshayahu, and his name of father is Amotz. Now, Amotz might be a connection to maybe the word Amitz, someone who is brave. It's a very interesting name. Asher Hazal Yehuda v'Yerushalayim, who had visions, who who spoke his visions, but had projections about Judah and Jerusalem. Bime Uziyahu, Yotam, Ahaz, Yechizkiyahu, Menchei Yudah. In the days of Uziyahu, Yotam, Ahaz, and Yechizkiyahu, kings of Judah. So he starts with an interesting prophecy because he starts, first of all, using testimony. So we've seen this principle testimony in other places. In Moses, we had it in previous places as well. I think one of the previous recordings we did, I mentioned this as well. Amos does something similar as well. It says, Shim'u shamayim va'azini eretz. So he says, hear the heavens and pay attention the earth. Shaman he'ezin are, and you have to put each one of them a different verbal stem for the basic form. They're both really to hear. Shama is the general idea of hearing. He'ezin comes with the idea of ozen, ear. So it has to do with to pay attention with your ears. But it's really the same principle. So the heavens have to hear and the earth has to pay attention to lend the ear. So invoking the heavens and the earth is a very common feature that we find because the heavens and the earth are considered to be something that will eternally stand, and therefore they are a very, very good source of testimony, or sorry, witness, sorry, because they will always be there and say, oh yes, I was there when it happened, and so on. It says, Ki Adonai diber, for the Lord has spoken. So he's bringing them as the source of testimony to what God said. Banim gidalti veromamti vehem pashauvi. I have raised and exalted sons, and they rebelled against me. So he's already making the principle of the riv, the principle of the argument of the heavens and the earth, and he's bringing them to testify against. So he starts going into these different metaphors. He says, Yada shol konel v'hamol evus be'alav. A ox knows the one who owns him, from the root kana, which can also mean to own or create. It depends on the context. And a donkey knows the trough of his owner, but he says Israel lo yada ami lo hitbonan. Israel didn't know. My nation did not pay attention. To do from the word hitbonen can also do to look with your eyes, but here it has to do with the mental principle, the idea of having wisdom to understand. So he calls out with the word hoy. Hoy is a word which appears in Hebrew as a lament of some sort. It says, Hoy goy chote, am kaved, aven, zera miraim, banim mashchitim. It says, woe to you, sinning nation, a people of heavy, aven, avon is more, it's not really just a sin, it's not a rebellion either, it's more of an iniquity of sorts. Zera miraim. A seed of wickedness, the seed of people who do wickedness. Banim mashchitim, sons who cause destruction, sons who are destructive in their behavior. Azvu et Adonai ni'atzu et kedosh Yisrael nazoru aho. They have abandoned the Lord. They have, ni'atzu is to spurn, it's to talk in great wickedness towards the Holy One of Israel. Nazoru aho, they have, to lihinazer is to prevent oneself from something. So they're preventing them from God by turning away from Him. So he says to them, Al me tuku od tosifu saram. What can you be struck more? He's saying this is an absurd situation. You are in a desolate situation and you're still holding to your rebellion. So he's describing them as a people who have been struck in every possible wound imaginable. There's nowhere left in their body that's not been struck. He's basically pointing out it's an absurd situation. How can he struck you more? And you add, you know, and you continue to sin. You continue to stray away. You're saying there's no way to punish you anymore. You're so blooded and full of wounds and bruises and everything. There's no way of punishing you anymore. So how is it even possible for you to even have to even continue? You shouldn't be even able to continue anymore. Kol rosh laholi v'chol levav davai. All the heads are sick. Rosh might relate to the idea of the head of Israel as a metaphor, but it also might mean each individual person. They're all Rosh can relate to the head of the person. Each individual person is sick, and all the hearts are mourning. And he continues the metaphor, says, or it might be the head is all sick, and the heart is also, it's also body and soul, which are in bad state. מכף רגל ועד ראש אין בו מיתום. This is verse 6. From the sole of the feet, from the feet themselves, kaf regel is the palm of the foot, and all the way to the head, there is nothing which is en bo mitom. There's nothing which is unblemished. Petza v'chabura u'makateria, a wound, an open wound, a bruise, or a petza can be just a wound. A chabura is a bruise, and makateria is an oozing wound. It's a fresh wound. Lo zuru velo chubashu. So zuru seems to be the removal of fluids to clean up the wound, but velo chubashu, wraps of no bandages have been placed upon it. Velo rukecha bashamen, and was not softened with oil, the cosmetics, basically the salves and so on to take care of the skin. And he says, now he's moving to, first of all, it's quite possible people were physically wounded, people were dying, people might have suffered scabies and other diseases because they malnutrition because of the destruction of everything. It's quite possible as well. But then he turns to the reality that they were in. Arzechem shemama, your land is desolate. Arechem serufot esh, your cities are burnt with fire. Admatchem lenegdechem zarim uchlim ota, your land before you, the land which is standing in front of you, which is laid before you, strangers are eating it. This actually might relate to an invasion by Edomites and Philistines. The Philistines actually, some of them showed loyalty to the Assyrians. Actually, the Assyrians and the Assyrians actually favored the Philistines. Some of the Philistines. Hezekiah was actually at war against the Philistines. One of the kings, I can't remember if it was the king of Ekron or the king of Aza. It's both of them. Actually, he states this. So there was a man called Mitenati, king of Ashdod, Hadi, king of Ekron, and Silibal, king of Gaza. They actually received land from this is lines 32, 33, and 34. These specific three kings were given land. But I think it was Padi, the king of Ekron, who was taken captive by King Hezekiah, by King Hezekiah, and he was forced to release him by the Assyrians. So the Philistines were actually showing loyalty towards the Assyrians, and this is really what was going on. He tore land from Judea and gave it to the Philistines. But we also know that the Edomites were invading as well. This is why Edomites appear at the beginning of the Second Temple and during the Second Temple as living in what we would consider Judea land, even though Edom is far away, you know, the other side of the Jordan River. They actually invaded southern Judea, and this is why we have a place like Bet Govrin, which is an Edomite city. Not too far away from Lachish, by the way. So it says, "Ushmama kimhapechat zarim," and is desolate like strangers have turned it over. They came and plundered, and it's moved away. It says, "Venotra vatzion kesuka vecharem," and vatzion here relates to Jerusalem. So he says, the daughter of Zion, which is Jerusalem, is left like a booth in a field, like a booth in a vineyard, which sticks out. It's not really supposed to be there because everything else is destroyed. Just Jerusalem is standing there by itself on its mountain and with its temple standing there as a final thing. And I don't think the word sukkah is chosen here randomly because there's a whole idea of sukkah David, the booth of David or the tabernacle of David as well. It says, kim luna v'miksha ki'ir netzura, as another type of booth. A meluna is a slightly more like a wooden structure maybe or something like that. In modern Hebrew, meluna is used to describe more of a doghouse, but this is more like a shed or something. Bemiksha. Miksha is probably a field of what you call zucchini, okay? Zucchini or cucumber. I've noticed in some places they call it cucumber, some places, but these are the more... zucchini, I think the proper name would be zucchini, these dark, long ones. Not a cucumber, which is you put in your water and so on. These are the actual ones you have to cook. So you can eat them raw as well. When I was trained to be a chef, I had one of my teachers used to eat them as they are. I used to eat them raw. But in any case, it says Ki'ir Netzorah. Now it says Ki'ir Netzorah as a siege city, but what do you mean like a siege city? It is a siege city. So all these details, and he says all these details, and the next verse is really very, it's really the point of Hopa, also very dramatic. All these descriptions really fit more the times of King Hezekiah, not King Ahaz. Ahaz was protected by the Assyrians. It was Chizkiyahu who rebelled. And so this prophecy is actually of the last king in the list, but it presents the main message. And the main message is, Lule Adonai Tzevaot hotir lanu sarid. If it wasn't for the Lord of hosts, army, Tzevaot, the word Tzava means army. It says God has been presented as a warrior here, a protective warrior. If it wasn't for the Lord of hosts who left for us a remnant. Now there's a bit of a debate where the stop should be. Should be remnant kimat, small remnant, or should you move the stop under the word sarid and say kimat kisdomainu la'amura diminu? So there's a debate between researchers where the stop should be, because it really can change. It changes the meaning, because he says he left us a remnant. We were almost like Sodom. We were almost like Sodom. And we resembled Amura. Or you can say, and this is how the cantillations work, if it wasn't that he left us a small remnant, like Sodom we would be, without the word almost. But the almost is very, very dramatic here. But it doesn't really matter where you place it, because the main point here, the main emphasis here, if you put it connected to the word remnant or the word Sodom, you're still left with the idea there's almost nothing left. There's maybe a few thousand people living in Jerusalem. There's a big debate. How do you calculate how many people actually lived there and so on? It varies from 5,000 to 30,000, depending. But if you understand, they were expanding there was a haste, and they were expanding to the western hill where the Jewish quarter is today in Mount Zion. Mount Zion used to be part inside the walls, and there was a whole story there that the Ottomans didn't really surround it, but historically it was part of it. Mount Zion was part of the city. And, people, refugees were running away. Nadav Naaman makes a certain claim about part of the roles of the Ger, the sojourners, relates to really people from the northern tribes who fled to Judea and basically built a tent city in the western hill, Jerusalem. So they're in dire state. It's a really, really, really bad place they're in. And then he, by association, continues, Shim'u devar Adonai ketzinei Sedom ha'azinu Torat Eloheinu am Amora. So we have the whole principle of association. So he ends with Sodom and Amora, Sodom and Gomorrah, and he continues. He says to them, you almost were, this is apparently something maybe people were saying, we're almost turned over, and like Sodom and Gomorrah. And he says, oh, okay, that's what you were saying. Listen to me, your behavior, because he's pointing out this is not happening just because, it's because of your behavior. There's a circumstance here. There's always the argument between secular people and religious people why something happened. And, you know, the prophet always points out it's not because your king rebelled against him, it's because your behavior is problematic. So this actually might be before the reform. This is the reform might have actually happened during this period, during the period of the destruction of Judea, realizing something was wrong. Or the reform might have happened after. There's a big debate about this one, when exactly the reform was. If you don't know what the reform is, King Hezekiah did a reform and got rid of all the statues and got rid of all the idol worshipping. So it says, Shim'u devar Adonai ketzinei Sedom ha'azinu Torat Eloheinu am Amora. It says, listen the words of the Lord, the officers of Sedom, pay attention with your ear. Shim'u and ha'azinu, like the heavens and the earth. Now he's referring to them with the same verbs. Hear, pay attention, heed your ears. The law, the Torah, the instructions of our God, the people of Amora. So he's relating both to the high-ranking people, the government, and the regular people as well. So he turns around and says that he's not against the principle of a temple. He's not against the idea of sacrifices and so on. But he says, you're doing this and this together. It's terrible. So he says to them, Lama li rov zivchechem yomar Adonai? Why would I want the magnitude, the large quantities of your zvachim, of your free offerings here, your offerings, says the Lord. So, you know, he's saying it doesn't help that you pretend and you're doing all these rituals and everything, but inside you're rotten. You know, and I can make a modern day comment about this, but I think the listeners are smart enough to understand what I mean. Savati olot elim v'chelev meri'im. I have satisfied. I am full of burnt offerings of rams, and the fat of meri'im, which is it's really another way. Either oxen or rams can be, but meri'im probably relates to the idea of just something which is just fattened. But some people say meri'im might be a certain kind of a wild ox or something, but probably relates to the idea of fattened animals. So we show up at the temple with all these rituals and everything, but inside everything is rotten. And this is, we have to think into ourselves as well. Are we doing this for the right reasons? Are we really understanding the meaning and the magnitude of the Torah which is upon us and correcting ourselves? There's an issue here of sitting down. I had a friend years ago used to say, you have to sit down every once in a while, kind of think about your life and see, am I doing things right? Am I going in the right direction in how I behave and how I make my decisions? And this is really what he's saying to them as well. Take responsibility. It says, V'dam parim uchvasim va'atudim lo chafatzti. It says, the blood of oxen and sheep. And atudim is probably another word again for types of maybe goats and animals like that. I do not wish. It's not really what I'm interested in. I want you to behave. But we never really hear saying we don't want the temple. Jeremiah never says that either. Yechezkel even goes in and says there's going to be a new temple. None of the prophets really attack the idea of the existence of the temple. But if you want to be close to God in that way, you also have to fix yourself in other aspects of life. It's not enough just to have, you know, I have a temple and that's it. And that's all we really need. He's criticizing the idea. If we actually go back to a little bit to the story of Balak and Bilam, he's criticizing the idea of pushing buttons and then everything is fixed. He's saying this, it doesn't work that way. So he says, I don't wish any of these things. Verse 12, Ki tavo lirot panai. If you come over to see my presence, to see my face, to show face here, who asked from you to trod, to trample my courtyards? The temple is still holy. You're not behaving properly. So he says, Lotosifu havim minhat shav. You will no longer bring grain offerings, false grain offerings. Now, minhat shav might also relate here to the idea of maybe the principle of the sota, something like that, maybe that they know that they sin but they still bring it. Ktoret to'eva hili, it is a burnt, because the word ktoret from the word katar is to make smoke, so it's a burnt offering, a smoked offering, which is an abomination to me. It says chodesh v'shabbat karom mikra lo'uchal aven va'atzara. It says a new moon and a Sabbath and the calling of a convocation, basically is covering new moons, Shabbat, basically, and the Mu'adim, Mikro Mikra. Because it says, Ele Mu'adei Adonai Mikra Kodesh Asher Tikri'u Otam Be'Mu'adam. This is really the verse in verse, I think it's 1 and verse either 4 or 5 in the book of chapter 23 of Leviticus, of Vayikra, where it says, these are the appointed times of the Lord, which you will call them at their appointed time. So he's referring to Kerom Mikra has to do with relating to calling them holy convocations. I cannot contain aven, a sin, a wickedness, together with the idea of the atzara. It's the atzeret. It's to be standing before God. It's like Doeg Edom, who spied on David in Nov, where he says that, you know, he's atzur lifnei Adonai, he's standing there before God, he's there for a ritualistic reason. He says, I can't have these sins together, mixed together with my holy convocations. So it says, Chodshechem u'mu'adechem sane'a nafshi. Your new moons and your feasts, your appointed times, my soul hates. I can't stand this together. I don't need this, all these things from you because of your behavior. God is describing they've become a burden upon me. I have become tired from carrying them. It's I'm not interested. You're showing up and you're just doing everything possibly wrong. I'm not interested in any of this. But again, it's important to say, he says, it's your new moons, it's your Sabbath, because it's you're focusing upon yourselves. You're just doing, oh, this is the time for us to go eat meat and celebrate and everything. But we're not looking inwards to fix ourselves. They weren't looking inwards to fix their behavior. So he says in verse 15, ufor ischem, kapechem ha'alim enayim mikem, when you spread your arms, in, when you open up your hands in prayer, your palms, when you open up the palms of your hands, I will turn a blind eye to them, I'll turn my eyes from them. Ki gam ki tarbu tefila enini shomea. Even if you increase prayer, you pray as much, you scream from the top of your voice, and I will not listen to you. And he says, Yadechem damim maleon. So now he's really getting to the point where he says, your hands are full of blood. Now the word damim here can also relate to money as well. You have a lot of debt in your hands, but he might also be talking about actual violence. There might have been factions, and we know probably were factions, and people were fighting one another and betraying one another and killing one another because of politics. So he says, Hatsu hizaku. He says, this, you have to solve this before I can even turn to you and help you. So he says to them, Hatsu hizaku. He's talking about the most basic things. If they have blood on their hands, go wash the blood away. But he's really saying, purify yourselves. Remove the sin. Physically purify yourself. Spiritually purify yourself. I will forgive you. There is hope. You can still return. He says, Hatsu hizaku. Wash and become completely clean. Hasiru roa ma'al alchem, remove the wickedness of your deeds. A ma'alal is like almost like childish behavior sometimes. Mineged einai chidlu harea, remove the wickedness of your deeds from before my eyes. Basically, stop. Stop doing wickedness. He says, limdu hetev, dirshu mishpat, asheru hamotz. He says, when he says, go study well, seek justice. So He's it's a hint here to keeping Torah as well, but he's focusing on the social principle. You're not doing justice. It says, Asheru Chamotz. So Asheru Chamotz is the question, what exactly Chamotz here really means. Some people argue that it has to do with, from the word Me'ushal, to make joyful, give joy to those who have been soured, those who have been dealt with badly. And therefore, chamotz relates to as a type of adjective towards a person. Some people say chamotz, you know, rectify chamotz. Chamotz might be a wickedness, so rectify the wickedness. So two different interpretations. So it says shiftu yatom rivu almana. So one of the reasons we really want to say asheru chamotz is a person and not just a wicked deed is because it also relates to Yatom and Almana, a fatherless and a widow. So do judgment for the orphan, basically take care of them. Do the argument, the riv, do the argument, the legal argument for the widow. Basically protect the weak. So chamutz might be someone whose wickedness has been done to them. They're being weakened. So now he goes back to the whole idea of hope, but he kind of jumps from one place to the other with this because there's still a lot he has to deal with. So he says, now let's bring the burden of proof. God says, and we've seen these prophecies before, says, let's bring a burden of proof. I can prove that I'm loyal to you. I can prove that good can happen to you if you do these things and test it, you will see. Let's go and see. Let's see what will actually happen. Yomar Adonai, the Lord will say, if your sins will be like the crimson. So shanim is a pluralization of the word shani, tola'at shani, which is what we call crimson, which is an orangey, bright orange, reddish color. If your sins would be like this ruddy orange color, they would turn white like snow. Im ya'adimu chatola'at, if they turn red like the worm, like the tola'at shani. So you split the word tola'at shani into shanim and tola'. So if they would be red like the tola'at, they will be like wool, like nice, clean, prestige wool, pristine wool. Im tovu ushmatem, if you desire and you listen, tuva aretz tochelu, the goodness of the land you will eat. He's talking about the land is destroyed. If you will, everything will come back. You'll be able to eat from the land. By the way, this is a bit of a counter to what Rav Shakeh says to them. He says to them in chapter, was it 36, I think, he says, you surrender to us and we'll take you to a land like your land and you'll eat and be happy and everything. He says, God says, no. I want you to stay on your land, but you need to behave properly. So what we're reading here is also a response to something that was probably going on, something they knew the Assyrians would say or already said. It says in verse 20, however, v'im tema'anu miritem, but if you refuse and you rebel, cherev t'ukelu, if you refuse and you rebel, a sword will consume you. Ki pi Adonai diber, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken. And then we go into a lamentation. There's a reason we read it, this one specifically, because of this, where he says, Echa haita lezona. Echa is a question. How? How is it? It's the word ech. Echa. It's an extended form of the word ech. It's the word how. But it relates to the whole idea of lamentations. Echa yashva badad ha'ir rabati am. How is it that the city, the great city, is sitting all by itself? And it says, Echa haita lezona. How is this? How was it like to become like a prostitute? Kiryam ne'emana, a loyal city. A prostitute is not loyal. She's not loyal to anyone. She sleeps with anyone. But it used to be a loyal city that remained loyal to the God of Israel. So there might be a relation here also to foreign deities. Meletim mishpat, I filled it with judgment, with justice. Tzedek yalin, but I filled it with law, with law-abiding structures. Tzedek yalin, but righteousness would dwell in it. Ve'ata meratzechim, and now they are murderers. They are all murderers as well. Kaspech, he starts talking about, he's using metaphors here about qualities. He says, Kaspech hayale sigim, your silver has become tainted. There are other elements inside your silver. Your silver is no longer pure. Sov'ech mahul b'mayim, your wine, your beverages are full with water. Sarayich sorim, your ministers are all going astray. V'chavrei ganavim, and they're friends with thieves, or they are like gatherings of thieves together, because the word chavrei can also be from the word chaver, which is friend, but also chibul, which is connecting, to the, like a gathering of thieves, like a den of thieves. And if I'm not mistaken, Jeremiah mentions something very similar as well. Kulo ohev shohad, they all like the bribe. Verodef shalmonim, and seek, they pursue for the payments. Yatom lo ishpetu, the orphan they will not judge. Veriv almana lo yavo alehem, and the argument, the judgment of a widow will not come before them. Therefore, in verse 24, lachen ni'um ha'adon Adonai tzevo, therefore the statement, the declaration of the master, the Lord of hosts. The reason they're using the word Adon here probably raised the idea of the Assyrians presuming them to be, the Syrian king presumes himself to be master, but he isn't. Avir Yisrael, the champion of Israel, going back to the military principle as well. Hoy en nachem et sarai, ve'en nakema me'oyevayiv. Hoy, no, he declares out, it shall be, the hoy here is used less with lament and more with declarative and strength and power. I will find condolence from my enemies, and I will find vengeance against my enemies as well. I'll find peace from them. Ve'ashiva yadi aleich, I will turn my hand, my authority upon you, Jerusalem, and Judea, and in Israel. Ve'etzrof kabol sigaich, and I will, like the process of burning out any other particles inside the silver, still maintaining that silver, so the sigim. As he says, Kaspech hayale sigim, your silver is full of contaminations. So same thing here, but like soap, kabol, so the word borit, or like a pit, like the silversmith's pit where he burns everything out. Va'asira kol bedilaich, and I remove all your bedil. Bedil is like a cheap type of metal, a substance that was used to harden, for example, copper and so on. But here, the silver doesn't need this material inside it. Says Vashiva Shoftaich Karvarishona. This is the great prayer we have every day in Judaism. I return your judges as in the beginning. Veyatzaich Kevatechila, and the ones who give you advice, which really means the ministers as before, as in the beginning as well. Achrecheni Kerelach Il Hatzedek, after that, they will be named the city of justice. Jerusalem, the capital, God's temple, and they're doing these things, is I will return this to what it really was, to bring back the justice. It's very interesting. He does talk about ritualistic issues, but what bothers God is the mistreatment of one another. And I argued many years ago when I was a teenager, I said, if you don't know how to treat your fellow man, how can you have a relationship with God? If you can't treat something which resembles you, how can you have a relationship with something which is different than you? Kiryah Ne'emana, a loyal city. The word Kiryah means a city as well. There's several words for city. Ir, Kiryah, Karet as well, appears as a Karet. So last verse says, Tzion b'mishpat tipadeh v'shoveh b'tzedakah. Zion, which is Jerusalem, will be redeemed by justice, by bringing justice. The doom is not here yet, but you can be redeemed. Veshoveh b'tzedakah. Shoveh is the ones who were taken captive. So all its captives can be returned with righteousness. B'tzedakah, the word said it, because it's really the seat of every king is supposed to be based on the idea of tzedek mishpatu meisharim, which was a fundamental principle. Even the Assyrians spoke about it, that certain patterns of behavior have to exist. So it's not by chance that he uses the word mishpat, tzedek. I'm surprised he never really put the word meisharim in there. Maybe it would be too much. It would take the metaphors out of balance and everything. But in any case, this is the real issue here is the hope. He says, you know, and even after we're approaching the destruction of Jerusalem, as Tisha B'Av, or they call the 9th of Av, or the 10th of Av, the 10th of the 5th month. And even there, there's hope. Still keep your eyes open. It can still happen if we mend our ways, if we go and do justice with one another, if we treat one another correctly, if we bring justice to everything that has to be done, and we bring back Torah to back on its feet. It's upon us to do these things. I hope you enjoyed this recording. If you are planning on fasting, I hope the fast is a useful fast, is a fast that will bring us a better understanding of what we need to fix in our own lives, and then fix as a population, as a community, as a society, to see the return of the God of Israel back to Jerusalem. Kol Tov.